My guest this morning, making a repeat appearance, Rabbi Artun and I have engaged now in, I believe, two dialogues on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, and we have enjoyed it as much as I know that some of you have. And usually we pick something about which we disagree, but this year I'm going to follow a suggestion, Ellie, that was made by you, which is I'm going to ask Rabbi Artun what he loves most or cherishes most or treasures most about the Jewish tradition. Because I think that it's a good occasion also to celebrate what it is that we have as well as to argue about it. And so over the course of the next however many minutes, we're going to talk about what it is in our tradition that we especially venerate and love. And so, one of the things that I sometimes say to the Bar Bat Mitzvah students is exactly that, which is if you had a non-Jewish friend who was asking you, what does Judaism teach that you think is really important, what would you pick? So what would you pick?
Rabbi Wolpe is... Rabbi Wolpe is graciously omitting that this is also a chance for me to not get in trouble this year. The odds of that are not good. So, what I think is miraculous about our tradition and isn't noted sneaks in the beginning of the Torah. Every other religious tradition in the ancient world says that the gods made people to do the grunt work that the gods didn't want to have to do anymore. Everyone, without exception. So in every tradition, the purpose of humanity are to be unappreciated slaves who do miserable work for the pleasure of these gods. And I don't know where the Torah got it. I have an idea where the Torah got it. But the Torah says something completely different.
Got it from God.
No. Got it from God. The Torah says that we were made to live in the garden and to care for the garden. Which means we're not here for utilitarian purpose to serve someone else. The world was set up for us. And we, because of that, take responsibility for the world. That has made all the difference. Out of that comes the notion of human dignity. Out of that comes the notion of vocation and a life of service. Out of that comes a notion that we're not simply some God's plaything, but that we are actually partners in the covenant of creation, which makes possible democracy, makes possible science, art, religion. I think it's all there in that kernel. That's what I would offer first.
So your teacher and mine, Simon Greenberg, used to say that the great innovation of the Ten Commandments was that the Ten Commandments taught that God cares about how I treat you. The Greek gods didn't care how people treated each other. They only cared how they treated the gods, but cared about how I treat you. So I let me just... Before I offer another, let me just put some pressure on that statement. You had art and science and so on before you had that conception of God. They don't make it possible, right?
Yes. So our teacher, Simon Greenberg, who was, in addition to being the rabbi of Har Zion, before Har Zion had a really extraordinary rabbi, but I'll tell you about him another time, was also the founding president of the then University of Judaism, American Jewish University, and I met him in New York. He was the vice chancellor of JTS, but he and Mordechai Kaplan used to come out to Los Angeles to create this new American Jewish University place. So he also taught that one of the ways you know an idea comes from God is the people that it comes through don't get it right away. And he said that both about the Torah, but he was also a big fan of President Lincoln. And he said it about the Gettysburg Address. that the ideas in the Gettysburg Address were so big that the people in Lincoln's generation didn't really know what it is he had actually said. And it's taken us 100 years to start to catch a glimmer of what it means. But I think that's true for the Torah too. The Torah wasn't speaking to that generation. It emerged through that generation, but it's speaking for all the generations.
Do you think that's why they don't get our sermons? I'm just thinking. It's just a thing. I'm just thinking.
Because they get mine.
Oh.
I'm not as smart.
So I would pick, not the only thing I would pick, I mean, I certainly wouldn't pick it over what you said, which I thought was very beautiful, but I would say that one thing that strikes me about Judaism that isn't true of any other religious tradition that I'm aware of is that Judaism acknowledges the right and validity of a human being to challenge God, and even to say that God is wrong, which is, after all, what Abraham does. At the beginning, it's called, and there's a phrase for it actually in the Yiddish Talmudic word, it's chutzpah klapei mala, which means chutzpah against God. And that idea, the idea that there's a long tradition of actually arguing with God, was one thing I remember years ago. I was at an interfaith conference with a Christian and an Islamic scholar, and I said something about the way in which the rabbis had changed or modified a law in the Torah, and he said, this is what we find so objectionable, the Muslim scholar said, about Judaism, because Islam means submission, and you're supposed to submit to God's will. And I said, this is what we find so wonderful about Judaism, is that God gave us minds and spirits, and we can actually create the tradition that we believe is in God's will, even though, or in God's larger will, even though it's not always exactly the tradition that we've received. So I might use that. I mean, look, the classic modern example, which is very powerful, is when Elie Wiesel writes that there was a Beit Din, a Jewish court, that was convened in Auschwitz and found God guilty. But realize that these were religious people who did it. They weren't secularists who found God guilty. And I can't conceive of any other religious tradition not only having that, but treasuring that as a model the way Judaism does.
Right, and what that means then is that we've taken skepticism, and far from making that a threat to the religious tradition, we bury it inside the religious tradition where it keeps the religious tradition recreating itself again and again.
And in fact, a part of that is that this is a model of what Judaism does. If you look on a page of Talmud or a classical page of Chumash, you have a dialogue in which people don't agree with each other very often. Rashi is the greatest biblical commentator, but on the same page of the Talmud are Rashi's grandsons, the Tosafot, who often disagree with their grandfather, and they're both enshrined on the page, which is a great thing.
Unprecedented. So let me offer another one. This one I knew about, but it never really caught my attention until my son brought it to my attention. Some of you know Jacob. Jacob is now 23 and struggles with his autism and also uses it as a way to see things that the rest of us sometimes miss. He was having to give a talk at Camp Ramah for Passover, and he talked about the biblical institution of Pesach Sheni, which no one talks about because no one talks about it anymore, right? Who needs it? But here's the catch. What does it mean? We take it for granted that the Torah says you have to be in a state of ritual purity to offer this sacrifice, this paschal sacrifice, and then you can partake in a feast with everybody in your community. What happens if you're on the road? What happens if you're in a state of ritual impurity? What if you can't, for one reason or another, offer the paschal sacrifice? Most religious traditions, and Judaism up till that time, would have said, well, if you don't fit in the category, then tough, you're outside. But God says, you know what, I need to make room for the people who don't fit in. So God says, if you weren't in a state of ritual purity for Pesach, you get to come back a month later and offer a korban. And so Jerusalem has a place for you too. You can sit on the hills of Jerusalem. Just because you can't do it the way the community does it, when the community does it, That's not the end. Then we just have to be creative. And the fact that God does that in the Torah means that we, in fact, are being told, you do that too. When you stumble across something in the tradition that's not right, your job isn't just to say, oh, sorry, but there's nothing I can do, you're left out. Your job is to wrestle. Now, sometimes you do have to still say, the door isn't going to open here. But a lot of times, if you think about it, there are resources within the Torah, and I love that about our tradition.
And that's why, even though the idea that you can bring an offering a month later if you can't do it on time, that's why here at Sinai, we will take your Kol Nidre pledge in October if you can't make it in September, because we're that kind of Torah true congregation. So thank you for that. Speaking of what you learned from your children, my daughter, who is leaving tomorrow for college and about to make me an empty nester, so I ought to quote what she said to me yesterday. Yesterday, you know, was Tashlich, when you go and you throw your bread on the waters. But since we're not driving, we went to Pilot Plaza, the Montparnasse Fountain, which we didn't even, by the way, throw the bread into the fountain because there's a drought. So what we did was we threw it into buckets, and when the religious school is going to take the buckets to the ocean. So we were ecologically conscious. But anyway, so as I'm about to go to Tashlich, I said to her, Samara, I'm about to leave for Tashlich. Is there any sin that you've committed that you would like me to atone for? I was half kidding, and she said, yes, the sin of wasting bread. So, but the reason, that one of the things I want to say, and this is in some ways a continuation of what I said earlier, is that Judaism's humor, even about itself and its own rituals, is also something that I love about the tradition, and that is very ancient. In fact, the book that we read on Yom Kippur, the book of Jonah, many biblical scholars believe is supposed to be a parody. It's supposed to be funny. Because all through the Bible, God will call prophets and they don't want to be prophets. Remember how Moses doesn't want to be a prophet? Ask someone else, don't ask me, and finally God forces him. So the idea that a prophet would actually literally run away, as though, you know, God won't see me if I run far enough, a lot of biblical scholars think we don't understand the humor anymore because we're so far from it, but that's what Jonah was written like. And that idea that humor is enshrined in the Jewish tradition and is woven through the Jewish tradition, I think is a beautiful thing. I got two more.
Good. So, one of the things that I love about our tradition is that it teaches that the only way you learn to love the whole planet is by starting with loving a piece of it. And that if you don't love an actual plot of land, then your love for the rest is just theory. And so for us, our love of Eretz Yisrael, wherever we are in the world, that's not in conflict with our love of other places. It's because of that that we know we can love other places. And I want to piggyback onto that. In the same way, the Jewish notion that we've been chosen is not because God disdains the rest of humanity. You can trust God's love for humanity because of the testimony of God's love for the Jews. A God who can't love any particular people can't love any people. But the genius of Judaism is to say that these things that are often seen as opposite, they're not, they're really the evidence that you can trust it. So we love the whole earth, how do you know? Because we've never gotten over our love for Eretz Yisrael. Wherever we wander, wherever we go, we're talking about it, we're thinking about it, we're pointing to it, we're singing about it, we're moaning it, right? That ability, and then our love for the Jews. Think of how counterintuitive it is.
That to love Jews? Just asking.
I like the Jews, theoretically. Actual Jews.
You know, that's Yitz, you know Yitz Greenberg's definition of anti-Semitism, right? Yitz Greenberg is an Orthodox rabbi. I should say that before I tell you his definition, otherwise you'll object. He said, anti-Semitism is hating Jews more than is absolutely necessary.
So, you know, we take it for granted that when Jews suffer anywhere in the world, We mobilize everywhere in the world. But that's not how other people operate. You know, Muslims suffer in some part of the world, and Muslims in other parts of the world don't think it's their issue. Christians suffer in some parts of the world, the rest of Christianity is doing fine. We take it for granted, right? And I don't know if you heard, Vice President Biden had a function at his home for the Jews, and he talked about how what he learned from us was that you care for everyone, and that that's noteworthy, and that comes from the very heart of our tradition. Nobody is left outside. When any Jew anywhere hurts, we all of us feel pain, and we all are responsible for each other.
What's the first question in the Bible? Where are you? What is the second question in the Bible? Everyone knows the first. The first question in the Bible is asked by God to human beings. Where are you? The second question is asked from Cain to God. Am I my brother's keeper? And the answer to the second question is the answer to the first. That is, from the very beginning, the idea is that human beings are supposed to be familial. And it's certainly true, the Soviet Union was a perfect example of that. There was no worldwide Christian movement to save the Christians who were persecuted in the Soviet Union. And that's why Sharansky has that beautiful, he has this beautiful passage in his first book, Fear No Evil, when he first got out of the Soviet Union. And he writes about the fact that there were Jews who became universalists, they became communists, and they ended up enslaving the world. And then there were Jews who remained particularists, who did what Rabbi Archon just said, who loved Jews. They became refuseniks and ended up liberating the Soviet Union. That in fact, loving particularly is more powerful than saying, I love everyone, which imposes no obligation on you whatever when you say, I love everyone, right? But if you say that you love the Jewish people, then you actually have to act differently towards Jews, and that's hard.
And the next step, though, is to get back to Bereshit doesn't start just for the Jews. So your particularism is your portal into universalism. Right? If you want to just be a universalist, then it falls flat. But your particularism can't end with your particularity. It has to be your portal into humanity as a whole and into the planet as a whole.
So why is it hard these days, do you think, for Jews to feel that sense of, harder than it used to be, for Jews to feel that sense of solidarity and community?
Look, sorry, that was a sigh of 3,000 years in the making. Look, I think that what is great about America is also its greatest challenge. Right? America is the land that celebrates individuality and our ability to do things on our own, by ourselves, our own way, without anyone else telling us otherwise. And there's a lot to be said for that. I also like listening to only the music I want when I want to listen. But we pay a very high price for that. Right? We don't reach out to actual human beings. We watch a video. And like you, I have spent hours watching very emotionally moving short video clips that at the end of the day leave me just as alone as I was when I started. Right? And so part of what I think the battleground has to be for all of us is how do we figure out how to make community accessible to people who don't know that they need it, right? And that's going to be the next fight for meaningful Jewish life, right? And I want to say here, in a sense, you've been granted a reprieve, right? Because you had a wave of people who came from a very tight community who get that. But the challenge then is going to be your kids and their kids who grow up in this broader American culture. And by America, I don't just mean the 50 states. It's true my family in Israel is having the same issues, right? That sense of, I'm going to take care of myself and do what I want most. Look, I think it makes it hard to retain friendships. It makes it a struggle to retain marriages. It's a struggle to build, to make the sacrifice to join a community and say, I'm not going to do it exactly my way. I'm going to put up with a Rosh Hashanah service that gets me 75% of what I want. But the 25% is the price I pay forgetting to know that you'll be in my life when I need you.
How much of a price do rabbis pay when they tell people they should do things? People don't like to hear that. If I stood in front of you and I told you all that you should keep kosher, most would ignore, others would be upset. Because the idea of prescriptive Judaism, that is, Judaism that says you should do this, you should do that, and you should do the other thing, runs against the ethos of American non-prescriptivism. And also, I just want to say one other thing, which is that the sense of difference, that is, you should be a different kind of community, also runs against an American ethos. Our friend and colleague Danny Gordas wrote about this years ago. When you watch a Disney movie, beauty marries the beast, the mermaid marries the man, all that matters is love, and differences shouldn't matter. And that doesn't work very well for the Jewish community, where we really believe in what Sachs calls the dignity of difference.
Look, and I think related to it, building on what you just said, we had the opportunity to have a debate with Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris a couple years ago about is there or is there not an afterlife. Hitchens now knows the answer to that question.
He's the only one of us that actually now knows, right?
And typical,
and he's not talking, Tom. He's not talking.
No,
it's a shame.
It is. But at one point, he got mad at me, and he did something that I truly despise. He started to psychoanalyze me, and he pointed out that the reason I believe in...
I wonder why you despise that.
I'm about to tell you.
No, sorry.
You can just bring the couch. Bring the couch, please. My mother is a psychoanalyst, so I grew up with this, so don't try to psychoanalyze me, because I've been done by the best. And he said that the reason I believe in an afterlife is I have a pathological fear of extinction.
Did dinosaurs scare you?
Well, don't say that again. So what I said to him, having been raised by a psychoanalyst, the only thing to do is analyze back, right? And I said to him, look, I could say to you that the reason you don't believe in an afterlife is because your pathological fear of taking responsibility. You want to be let off the hook, right? I think that's a challenge for Judaism, because what we offer to the world is a message of responsibility. And we live in a world in which no one wants to be responsible. Have you noticed when people apologize, they do so without saying they're wrong now? I'm so sorry you were offended. That's not an apology, that's an insult. So we live in a culture that runs away from responsibility and obligation, and it's a kind of permanent infantilization. No one wants to be a grown-up anymore. And that's part of why Judaism will remain unpopular. But I'm okay with that. So long as we have a big enough kernel of people who are willing to be grown-ups, then we will help take care of the children, and we will pass that along to a small minority in the next generation. That's what we've been doing all along. That's good enough.
So you like that Judaism grows adults.
Right. Exactly.
You've
right.
done well.
Correct.
If done well. Last comment. What do you tell me? A Jewish ritual that you particularly treasure, and why?
So I keep quoting him, but I will tell you that what has become my favorite Jewish ritual is that when we bless our children, and I know everybody does that, when Jacob was 14, I went to reach for his head, and he reached for mine. So we now do a family blessing every Friday night where we do a great big hug and we all bless each other and then we all kiss each other afterwards, and whoever we're with is part of the circle. So sometimes it's a circle of three and sometimes it's a circle of six. If you're with us, you're family. And I think that captures everything I love about Judaism. The words of the blessing are from the Birkat Kohanim. When I was in Jerusalem, years ago, many of you have seen this too, at the National Museum, they found the oldest fragment of Bible up until then was a fragment of Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing. I have a replica that I wear around my neck. And I think what a privilege it is to be a people who have been blessing their children continuously for this jewelry is from 800 BCE, so 3,000 years of blessing our kids. and of receiving blessing, and that we do it not alone. We do it with the people we love. That to me is everything I love about Judaism.
I also actually, it's related to that blessing. I'll take Shabbat candles, and I'll tell you why. This is called a Ner Tamid. But actually, Tamid in the Bible doesn't mean an eternal light. It means a light that is lit regularly. Tamid means a constant light. They would light the lights in the temple at regular intervals. And I think of the Shabbat candles as actually the Jewish Ner Tamid. Because, again, for thousands of years, in homes all over the world, we have and still do light this candle that is a continuous bringer of light into the world. And when you light it, of course, you say, Baruch Atah Adonai, which are, I think, the most powerful three words in the Jewish tradition. Blessed are you, O God. And the reason that they are is because you don't say you to anything or anyone that's not present. When you say, blessed are you, God, that means God's right there. And at that moment that you say it, you're supposed to feel God's immediate presence. And if you're lucky enough to light Shabbat candles each week, I think that you can say that that is one of those moments of stillness before everything else rushes in that allows you to feel that God is present. And ultimately, of course, that is Judaism's role in the world, which is to bring God's presence into the world through all the things that we just talked about, through goodness, through care, through love, through ritual, through community. All of that is supposed to be God's sort of rolling presence through the world, and in that one moment each week, it's crystallized. So if there is one ritual that I think is important, and by the way, it's after you light the Shabbat candles that you bless your children. So this continuous ritual, I think, would keep Judaism and its values going for forever and ever. Because as we know, one of the things that we're promised is not that Jews will always be many, but that there will always be Jews. And with that, let's go back to the service and conclude. We want to thank Rabbi Artson once again, and of course, to Milo Mandel for helping me bring up the chairs.